This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. For most of us, thinking about our own death is not a pleasant subject. There's a natural tendency to want to put your head in the sand and think about literally anything else. But as with a lot of things in our lives, a little planning now can save a lot of confusion and heartache later. Today on the show, we are going to break down the process of creating an advance directive, or living will. It's the third installment in our weekly January series, In Good Health. Now, you might be thinking, why is a conversation about death and dying part of a series on health and wellness? Well, for one, we won't just be talking about death. We're also talking about how to prepare for very serious medical situations. And how to alleviate stress and pain from your loved ones who might have to make medical decisions on your behalf. Here to guide us in this conversation is Nina Keck. She's a Vermont Public senior reporter whose work focuses on aging in Vermont. She joins us from Rutland. Welcome.
Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Nina. And Nina has a new story out today on vermontpublic.org about advance directives if you'd like to learn more. Also joining us from Rutland is Eva Zivitz, a registered nurse who coordinates the palliative care program at Rutland Regional Medical Center. She helps patients navigate end-of-life issues there. Eva, welcome.
Thank you.
And last but not least, we have Cindy Bruzzese, the executive director of the Vermont Ethics Network. Medical decision-making is a big part of her work there. Cindy, welcome.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can join our conversation as well. Have you made an advance directive recently? Or perhaps you've had to refer to one on behalf of a parent or a loved one. You can give us a call at 800-639 or send 2211. I should tell you the second half of that. Or send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Nina, there are a lot of different documents that sort of start swirling around when people start thinking about planning for their death. There's wills and DNRs, do not resuscitates, and then there are advance directives. What exactly is an advance directive?
Well, that may be a better question for Eva because she can get into the particulars of it, but it's basically, from my reporting, an outline of what you want and what you don't want as far as healthcare when you can't speak for yourself. And every state handles these documents a little bit differently. Vermont allows you to write your own. Many doctors encourage, you know, the more personal, the more intimate, the more specific, the better. But it's basically a guideline for your loved ones that when something happens and you are seriously ill or you've been in an accident and can't speak, others know exactly what you're thinking or, you know, what you've thought about as far as what your limits are health-wise.
Well, Eva, what are the different medical scenarios that a patient might need to navigate as we talk about these advanced directives here?
Well, I know in my own personal experience, and maybe that's the part that I can, throw into this discussion, yeah. I started thinking about the importance of advance directives many years ago on a family reunion trip to Wisconsin. My family, my husband's family, our little kids, siblings, we were all there. And over cold beers on the deck, my husband brought out advance directives and said, I know this is kind of a buzzkill, but we're going to take an hour with my family and we're going to take an hour with your family and sit down and talk about this. And Michaela, it was a godsend. It was truly a gift for all of us, especially my family, because my parents both talked to my brother and I about what they wanted if something happened. And I remember my dad very clearly, a very strong Catholic, saying, well, if I can't speak for myself and your mother is dealing with these decisions, I want a priest involved. And my mom had different perspectives. The very next spring, my dad had what would be a fatal stroke and was in the situation where he couldn't speak. He couldn't swallow. We had to make some really awful emotional decisions. And thank goodness we had his advance directive in place. My brother knew what it was. I knew what it was. My mother, we had all talked about it. We got a priest, and it was so sad, but there was much less agony, I guess. There was much less of a burden in making the decisions that we knew my dad would have wanted. So that kind of, I remember that clearly. And it came up when my mom passed away last spring. You know, she had an advance directive in place. She could communicate until the very end, so we didn't need it. But there was a sense of relief that, oh, yeah, we've talked about this. We know what mom would have wanted if the situation gets to a certain point. And I think in chatting in my reporting with Eva and in talking with other geriatricians and folks that deal with this, having those discussions is perhaps more important even than the documents.
So, Eva, when patients come to you at Rutland Regional, are you often the first person in their lives to tell them, hey, we should think about creating an advance directive?
Maybe the first person that's really sat down and said, you know, we should have a conversation about it. Federal law says that a hospital has to ask someone if they have an advance directive every time they're admitted to the hospital. And that's something that some people find a bit objectionable. Why are you always asking me this? Am I going to die? But it's something that we want to make sure we're very aware of in case something happens while you're in the hospital. So, but being asked whether there is one is different than sitting down and saying, you know, have you thought about these issues? What are your goals? What are your values? What kinds of things are important to you? And have you considered naming someone to speak for you and putting some of these thoughts down on paper?
So when you first start having those conversations with people, I can imagine there's some folks who, you know, say, oh, thank God, I've been worried about this. Let's get it all out. And others who are very reticent to start having this conversation. And maybe it brings up those fears around death. Do you have any tips for how to just begin putting down just the first bits of information you might need in an advance directive without, I don't know, scaring someone or scaring yourself away?
I think it's definitely a less scary thing if it's done before someone has a serious illness. So I think the earlier the idea is introduced, the more it can be separated from the fear of death. I think when people avoid doing it, when primary care physicians and attorneys and family members don't bring it up because they don't want to be depressing, and then someone does have a diagnosis, then it is a very scary thing to bring up. And at least for me, I try and focus the conversation on not death, but living. What kinds of things make your life worthwhile? What kinds of things are important for you to have a good quality of life and for you to feel like you are actually living rather than just existing? And can we craft something that helps your family understand those values, that helps your physicians and other caregivers understand the things that are important to you, so that when the treatment team makes recommendations or suggestions about interventions or treatments that can be done, we can do so with an understanding of who you are and how you want to live your life. We're not steering you down a path that's going to make you miserable if you're nearing the end.
If you have questions about how to create an advance directive or what exactly one is, you can give us a call at 800-639-2211. Cindy Bruzzese with the Vermont Ethics Network. What role does your organization play in helping people create advance directives?
Well, the Vermont Ethics Network has been doing this work since the early 80s. We basically are the place that produces all of the forms that I think most people have become very familiar with. And certainly hospitals and healthcare facilities and healthcare providers are quite familiar. So we are the place that provides templated forms that people can use, keeping in mind you don't have to use the forms that are produced by the Vermont Ethics Network. You can use any form. In fact, Vermont is quite permissive in terms of how you can complete an advance directive. All you need to do is make sure that it's properly signed and witnessed. And it is an advance directive, whether you wrote it on a piece of paper or whether you use a form that your attorney crafted or whether you use a form that we crafted or some other form that you found online. But we have created materials, resources to help explain these documents to people. We do community education, provider education. We have been for many, many years trying to support people to engage in these conversations, which we call advanced care planning conversations. And we also oversee Vermont's Advanced Directive Registry, which is a secure repository where people can send their completed advanced directive documents, where they would then be immediately accessible to healthcare providers or facilities at the time when a person is not able to speak for themselves. So we've been playing a pretty extensive role in Vermont for many years in terms of supporting people to exercise their right to be self-determining and having the paperwork and some supporting education to help people answer questions.
In terms of that repository that you mentioned, I learned, I believe from talking to you, Nina, that even a back of the napkin note about what you want to happen in this time that's signed by you and, you know, witnessed by a couple buddies, that's legal. That can be a legally binding document. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep, that's correct.
Yeah. Nina, when you started doing this reporting for Vermont Public about advanced directives, you report about aging, the aging population a lot. But I'm curious to hear what kind of conversations you were having with, with family members and with friends when you brought up that you're reporting on advanced directives. Were folks like, oh gosh, I really need to do one of those, or I've never heard of them before? What's the general kind of like knowledge base that you found that people have?
Pretty much everything. Yes, I've done it, or oh, that's been on my mind. So many of my friends in the age group that I'm in, I just turned 60, and a lot of us are dealing with aging parents, or we've lost parents and been through it. Or we have spouses that are getting sick and things are happening. And I think just sort of confronting the emotional aspects of you know, our own mortality. Yeah, everybody was at different phases. We even joked that my husband and I talked about having advanced directive dinner parties to kind of walk people through and use, as Cindy was saying, the Vermont Ethics Network has such great information on its website. There are ways to start the conversation. But I think just starting the conversation and thinking about the fact that, yeah, this is kind of helpful. We think about writing our wills, but this is also another gift we can give our loved ones just to have some of these things mapped out. But yeah, my friends are all over the place. Some have a very organized and it's all done and filed. Others say, yeah, I started it. It's in some file. I'm kind of in the middle too. My husband and I were working on ours, sort of updating them recently. But, you know, it's never too early. The other thing that Eva Zivitz brought up to me that I hadn't realized is, you know, it's never too early. And she recommends, and she can talk about this, I'm sure, anybody over the age of 18 should at least pick a person whom they want to speak on their behalf if they can't. And over the Christmas break, I brought that up at dinner with my two adult 20-something daughters. And they, you know, I said, hey, by the way, if something were to happen, and they both kind of did the thumb signal at my husband, who's a physician in Rutland and very good in a crisis. And
I thought, said, oh, that
thanks,
guy?
We're all straight. There you go.
Yeah, Eva, is that a message you try to impart to folks who come across your desk at Rutland Regional, that you can't be too young to think about these things?
Absolutely. I think, you know, families come in all shapes and sizes and all different dynamics. And in some states have laws that specifically delineate who would make decisions in a time of crisis if someone doesn't name a specific decision maker. But Vermont is not one of those states. So it can be difficult if there are estrangements, difficult relationships in the family, blended families that don't all see eye to eye. When one member gets sick and hasn't named a decision maker, it can be really difficult to get families to come together and come up with decisions on end of life. Mm. So you can really help your family by choosing a person yourself and setting that out in a legal way so that if something happens, even if it's unexpected, like a car accident, we know who to turn to to start to help make some big decisions.
Well, we've discussed why advance directives are so important. And coming up, let's dive into some of those sticky situations, such as the one you just mentioned, Eva, where family members might disagree on the best path forward. That's in just a minute on Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, we are discussing advance directives, also known as living wills. It's part of our weekly health and wellness series every Thursday in January called In Good Health. Our guests are Eva Zivitz, a nurse and head of palliative care at Rutland Regional Medical Center, Vermont Public senior reporter Nina Keck, who reports on aging, and Cindy Bruzzese, executive director of the Vermont Ethics Network. If you have questions about how to put together an advance directive or a personal experience with having to refer to one for a friend or a loved one or family member, give us a call at 800-639-2211. Cindy, you deal with the complicated ethics around end of life and end of life medical care quite a lot in your job. What happens if a family member perhaps morally disagrees with what a person put into an advance directive? Can they override it in any scenario?
Well, that's a great question, and it certainly is a frequently recurring reason why an ethics consult is called in a hospital setting when there's disagreement about the care plan. I think one of the things that someone said to me a long time ago that really stuck is that providing emotional support for families without clarifying the ethical and legal obligations owed to the patient sometimes sets up a dynamic where those family members think they have a decision to make about the patient's care plan when they actually don't. And by this, I mean that when individuals indicate preferences in their advance directives, things that they would find acceptable, things that they would not find acceptable, we are ethically and legally obligated to respect those wishes to the degree that they apply. And I qualify that because there are times where people ask for things that just aren't medically feasible or reasonable to do. And so we have to look at it in a holistic way. But agents named, which is what a healthcare agent is, the name that we ascribe to the person who's been designated in an advance directive to make decisions. They do not have the authority to override the prior decisions made by the patient when they had the capacity to make those decisions. If respect for self-determination and patient autonomy is to have any meaning, we have to abide by the information that people are telling us about what matters to them. Because at the end of the day, the goal of all of these documents is to try to align the care and treatment that is provided to patients with what they value. That's really what this is all about. And so we do need to listen to those documents to apply them when they apply to the scenario at hand. And we do need to support family members with great palliative spiritual care, case management support, emotional support, but we need to be clear that our obligation is to the patient and to their wishes and their values.
What you're saying reminds me of an email that we got ahead of today's show from a listener named Barbara, who wrote to us about a really difficult experience when her grandmother died. Her grandmother, she writes, didn't have an advance directive. She was pretty much unresponsive after being hospitalized after a fall, and her mother and uncle were asked to make medical decisions. At 94, Barbara writes, my grandmother was still fairly independent, but it didn't look like she would recover. So my mother and uncle agreed that no extraordinary measures, should be taken to extend her life. Cut to a few days later, and they found out that her grandmother hadn't been fed or given fluids. And her mother and uncle, Barbara writes, didn't understand that no extraordinary measures meant no food or fluids. They thought it just referred to no CPR, no intubation. And Barbara goes on to say, please understand fully the choices you are making. Don't assume you understand the medical language, as it can be different from what everyday people think. Make an advance directive, but understand all your choices. Eva, is this type of situation something you've come across in your career?
Every day, In doing these documents, we're asking people to comment on some very complex medical interventions. And I think a lot of people tend to get their information on things like CPR, ventilators, feeding tubes from television, movies, and by word of mouth rather than directly from people in the medical community who actually know what's happening. And so one of the struggles I have with helping healthcare agents and families honor advance directives is really trying to understand what the person meant when they made a choice about whether or not they wanted CPR or whether or not they wanted to be on a ventilator. So I think the listener that wrote in is exactly right. I think it's key to make sure that you really understand what is being said and by medical professionals, and that it's important for medical professionals to put things in language that lay people can understand. I had an example just recently of someone who said they wanted to be defibrillated, but did not want chest compressions in the event that their heart stopped. And that's not really a medically feasible path of treatment to take. So if, when that person were theoretically to put those wishes down on paper, and then their family is asked to make decisions on their behalf, family's trying to make decisions based on an erroneous choice. So it's very, very complicated to try and parse all this out and make sure we're doing the ethically correct thing, and the medically reasonable or feasible pathway.
Right. Eva, hearing you describe how many people learn about the medical world through TV shows like Grey's Anatomy or ER, that hit very close to home for me. And Nina, you've been generous enough to share your own personal stories around creating advanced directives with us today. I wonder what how helpful it was to have your spouse, who is a medical professional and kind of knows the ins and outs of this world and the language around medical procedures. How helpful was that in figuring out your own family's advanced directives?
It was so helpful because, as Eva Zivitz was just explaining, there are so many different scenarios that you can come up against, and the forms are, they're pretty basic. But I think when I was interviewing Dr. Imi Janari at the UVM Health Center, she was explaining how you can take your advance directive, make an appointment with your primary care doctor. There's a paying mechanism for that. So it's not like, that's not an option. And I think a lot of health professionals would recommend that you talk over your advance directive with your own personal physician provider, because they can explain some of the gray areas that frankly are hard to wrap your head around if you're not in the situation. And the other thing that I think is really interesting is how this whole sort of thought process can be fluid. And Dr. Janari was explaining to me that her patients routinely change their mind. So it's one thing when you write your advanced healthcare directive when you are 60 or 65 and fairly healthy. It's another thing entirely when you're in the hospital at 82 dealing with a serious situation. You may change your mind. Things may, you may want to adapt things. And but you asked for me personally, yes, it's very important and it's been very helpful for me to have a medical mind to bounce these things off of. But anybody out there that has a primary care doctor can do that as well.
Yeah, that's a great thing to know. We just got an email from Ray in Jamaica who writes, "I have a very detailed advance directive filed away. When you're a single mother going into brain surgery, it is just about the strongest kick in the pants out there to finally get it done. Ever since then, I have been nudging others to do the same and to be as detailed as possible. It's your life and should be your death, your choices. Don't put it off. Living wills are essential. I need to reread mine and possibly change things up because another brain tumor has just been found." Well, Ray, I'm so sorry to hear that news, and we will be thinking of you, wishing you all the health that there is. And thank you for your note. Let's go to the phones. We have Xenia in Barrytown calling in. Xenia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to caution people about being a vigorous advocate if you're someone's healthcare agent under an advance directive. And I agree with all the people who said it's a good idea to have an advance directive. I had the experience of being the healthcare agent for a friend who subsequently ended up in the Vermont State Hospital. And the problem was getting the hospital staff to follow her wishes as laid out in the advance directive. And this is perhaps most vital in a psych situation, but studies have shown that whether medical systems actually followed people's wishes, and they found very often their wishes were disregarded. And often I think the medical people don't have great respect for patients or their healthcare agents, and that has been what people found in the case of my friend.
Xenia, I'm so sorry to jump in here, but I just want to get the opinion of Cindy Bruzzese with the Vermont Ethics Network on this very sticky situation that you're bringing up. I can only imagine how hard that was for you. And I wonder, Cindy, what resources are available for somebody who is trying to make sure that a loved one's advance directive is followed and might be getting some pushback from medical staff? Has that come up for you?
Yeah, I think it does come up. I think in hospital settings, often they could trigger, that could trigger an ethics, a request for an ethics consult, where someone is seeking to have a review and have another lens kind of look at a situation to make sure that we're not missing something and that we have all the facts we need. In my work, you know, good ethics starts with good facts. So it's an opportunity to really look at a particular situation where there's conflict and try to sort out what's going on and make some recommendations. The other place that I think those types of challenging situations go to is sort of a patient and family advocacy office within a healthcare setting, where someone can bring a complaint or a concern to have that reviewed and then to engage the right folks to make sure we're doing things the way we should be. I think health systems and healthcare providers really do try to do the right thing all the time, but sometimes there's extenuating factors or there's just not all the information that they need. And then it's an opportunity to bring other people to the table to try to sort through it and move forward in a way that respects the patient's wishes ultimately, because I think this is our primary obligation. I guess I should qualify that. We do our best to respect patients' wishes and values. We can't always do everything patients want us to do, but I do think, you know, in the situation that your caller is describing, that sounds very distressing indeed. And I think your friend was lucky to have you as an advocate looking out for her. That's probably the most, or him, that is the most important important thing for a healthcare agent to be, is someone who's not afraid to be an advocate and to ask questions and to push back if need be, to take a pause to make sure we're really doing things in accordance with what the patient has stated their values are.
On that note, Eva, is there any advice that you might have for folks who are trying to figure out who that their healthcare advocate should be? You know, do people ever choose somebody who's, you know, not their spouse, even if they have a spouse, or, you know, not their closest living relative?
People do. I think most people have the tendency to want to name the person that they're emotionally or legally closest to in relationship, but that's often not the best person. As Cindy alluded to, one of the characteristics you really should be looking for in an agent is someone who is able and willing to advocate for what your wishes are, even if they may not necessarily agree with those wishes. There are times when, in an effort to do what medical professionals think is the right thing, which is often prolonging life.
Yeah.
A healthcare agent needs to be very strong and say, you know, in this case, this person may not want those interventions and you must listen to me as their representative. And sometimes you have to be kind of strong. So I've seen, you know, people name grandchildren, friends, cousins, attorneys. There are some excellent materials on the Vermont Ethics Network website. One of my favorites is a quiz that the person who's doing the advance directive can take and their potential agent can take and then compare their answers about what the person themselves would want. And so you can kind of interview your potential agent and say, how close are you in understanding how I would make these decisions for myself? And it can be used as a way to rule out someone as a potential agent or as a tool to have more conversation with that agent so that you have a better understanding of what to do.
Well, Nina Kege, it sounds like in your family, that wasn't too much of an issue. Your daughters knew right away your husband was the guy.
I thought that was pretty funny, and it was not a surprise. But, you know, the point I think that Eva was bringing up, that it's not necessarily the person closest to you, and the fact that it needs to be someone that has the temperament that can stand up and is good in a crisis. Because you got to remember, and having just gone through this with my mother last spring, you know, close family members, you are in the midst of a shocking, emotional, and really gut-wrenching experience if you're standing in the ICU or in the ER with someone that you love. And it takes a lot to listen to what the doctor or the, you know, the nurse is telling you and then try to think back, oh, yeah, when we had this conversation. So it is not necessarily an easy task, but, you know, it is nice that you can fall back on those conversations and that document to kind of look back on and say, oh, yeah, here it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Sharon calling in from Rutland. Sharon, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm very glad that you're having this show today. I wonder, I heard the comment about bringing in other people in discussions and mentioned the word spiritual. And understanding that a person's religious and spiritual or simply spiritual or non-beliefs, how those impact decision-making. I guess a case in point, too, is when it was mentioned about somebody having difficulty with the family member not given food or water, and the family didn't understand. And I think coupled with that is maybe the concept of killing a person rather than explaining that the reason why those things are sort of withheld is because the person is dying. So I just would like to understand your comments about the spiritual aspect.
Well, thank you so much, Sharon, for that thought. We do have to take a quick break, but right when we come back, I want to return to the ways in which a person or a family's spirituality or religion could affect decision-making around end-of-life care and the creation of these advance directives. So we'll get to that in just one moment here on Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you are just joining our conversation, we are talking about advance directives. It's part of our weekly series we're running every Thursday in January called In Good Health. Our guests are Eva Zivitz, a nurse and head of palliative care at Rutland Regional Medical Center, Vermont Public senior reporter Nina Keck, who reports on aging, and Cindy Bruzzese, executive director of the Vermont Ethics Network. Right before that break, we had a caller, Sharon, call in and ask a question about how spirituality and religion can affect some of the decision-making around advance directives. Cindy, I'd love to hear from you first on this.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to remember that advance directives are, at their core, values-based documents. And so people's experiences, their religious beliefs, their cultural beliefs all play a part in shaping how someone completes an advance directive and where their priorities are. So these are preference-based documents. So it's not uncommon to see documents that that vary from one faith tradition to another, or for people that have religious beliefs or different cultural backgrounds where their views on issues around life prolongation, death and dying do vary, and that's reflected in the way they approach treatment and care decisions. And so these are often situations that we're navigating individually with that patient, if they still have the ability to make decisions for themselves, and or with their families or those people closest to them who are in the position of making decisions, to try to do our best to align the care and treatment with those values as best we can. So I think that spirituality and faith and religion and culture all play a really important role in how we provide good person-centered care, particularly for people that maybe aren't as able to engage with us around specific decisions.
Hmm. Well, somewhat relatedly, we got an email from a listener named Alden, who is a hospitalist at RRMC, so a colleague of yours, Eva. They write that they have discussions about end-of-life care with patients on a regular basis. They are always challenging, but sometimes revelatory and thoughtful conversations. One important aspect of such discussions is that they should not be one and done. Advance directives should be living documents and discussions with those around us about our values and quality of life. At the end of it, the discussion should be, what kind of life do we want? What quality of life do we accept as living? And what situations or conditions would we not want? Advanced directives typically address catastrophic events and measures such as CPR and intubation. Careful thought should also be given to when a person reaches the point where they are, quote, looking for the exit. Eva, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on Alden's email there and the importance of thinking not just about catastrophic events, but that kind of murky period where someone might be, as Alden puts it, looking for the exit.
I think he's exactly right. That thinking that you can make a set of decisions about the end of your life and then that's it, and that you can, you know, kind of have those decisions fit whatever situation comes, is not realistic. So ongoing conversations are absolutely key with the person themselves as much as they are able. Even if they don't have full capacity, they may still be able to be part of conversations about what they want and don't want. Examining the documents on a regular basis as age and health and life circumstances change is important, but there's going to be conversations in the moment as decisions have to be made, because you can't account for any and all circumstances that might come. Keeping the focus on, as I had said before, and I think Dr. Hall said quite eloquently, keeping the focus on living and how someone wants to spend their time, if that time might be short.
Well, let's return to the phones. We have Giovanna calling in from Montpelier. Giovanna, what are your thoughts listening to this discussion?
Hi, Michaela. I have always, as an anthropologist, I've always thought that we needed to talk a whole lot more about dying. And in May, my husband, David, died after 12 days. He was diagnosed on one day, and 12 days later, he was dead of a very, very aggressive cancer. So here's couple of practical comments just enforcing what the other brilliant ladies were saying. First is that most of our advanced directives are done with an attorney, which is really pretty scary if you think about it. So we're doing a will. He hands us, he or she hands us an advanced directive and says, go through this and sign it. So that is certainly how ours happened, you know, in our 50s. Then David is, we think he's just in the hospital temporarily. And then all of a sudden we realize, well, he's about to die here. And so the advance directive that we signed as kids saying, oh, yeah, if we are drowning in the lake, resuscitate us. So next week we can go canoeing again. So that first advance directive was right out of Hollywood. And in real life, the very wise physician at Central Vermont Hospital said, you know, Dave's not ever going to have a heart attack, but he will have heart failure because he may have heart failure because of how sick he is. And so do you really want to resuscitate him? And I said, what? Was that in the advance directive? And he said, yes. And so we knew Dave was still very articulate at that point, even within 2 days of dying. And we realized, no, do not resuscitate. We do not want to live without a quality of life. So the point is that these things are dynamic documents, just to reinforce what the lady said. They're often done in the lawyer's office. I love the idea of doing them with a physician. Of course, most Vermonters don't even have a primary care physician. So are there other resources that they can tap into so they can make more informed decisions working, say, with... thank you. That's all I have. Thank you so much,
Yvonne. I'm sorry to jump in on you there by accident. And I am so sorry for the loss of your husband, David, after such a short illness. Your question there about, like, who are the other people that can help out with this besides just an attorney who helped you make your will that one time 20 years ago? I think that's a great one. Nynakek, is this something that you kind of dove into when you were putting together this primer for people who are just starting to think about advanced directives?
I did. And Cindy Brzezi's website with the Vermont Health Network is fantastic. And they have not only advanced directive forms in English, but I think 14 different languages, which is tremendous. And there are also great videos. I think I linked one with my story that I thought was funny and also really telling about choosing your healthcare advocate, you know, going through what are the characteristics in a friend that you want and don't want. But I think there's so much information out there. The Vermont Health Network has a ton. So if you are listening to this program and thinking, boy, you know, I really should start this project, that is a great place to start. And, you know, you can take it from there because they've got wonderful links on all sorts of questions to get the conversation rolling and, you know, forms that you can download. It's really terrific.
Mm. Well, let's go to Cynthia, who's calling in from Florida now. Cynthia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. Let me get off of speakerphone for you.
Thank you.
My apology. Certainly. There we go. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts listening?
I have two comments. Mm-hmm. Well, my concerns are I'm thrilled to hear about the Advanced Directive Repository. And given that, what is the reason for still additionally requiring an appointed person who may not agree with your wishes? And the other question is, and of course, once I move to Vermont soon, I will be filing my directives because I've been frustrated that the VA requires a new set of DNR paperwork for each surgery. And I thought I could just file it one place and not have to go over it again. Mm. And the other is, just like we have an organ donor stamp on our driver's license, I would love to see an additional link that could be put there to connect to advanced directives for any hospital to link it right away.
Yeah, great idea. A way to make that communication a little bit easier, especially at such a difficult time. Yeah. Cindy Brzezi, could you address our caller Cynthia's first question? Why appoint anyone when, you know, the document is filed, it's in a repository, and, you know, it should be just right there, ready to go?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I appreciate the caller making it. I think the challenge with advanced directives is always that they are future oriented, right? So we're always thinking, we're asking someone to think about a time later when they won't be able to make decisions for themselves and to be able to anticipate how they're going to feel about what things they would or wouldn't want. And also without having knowledge about what's actually wrong and what we have available to fix it and what's it going to take to fix it, if it's even fixable. Mm. So when you think about it, we're really asking them to try to look into the crystal ball and give us an answer. And you can imagine how hard that is to do with any real accuracy. So while people do put, I think, lots of specific information into their advanced directives, the situation that happens to them that lands them in the hospital without being able to make decisions for themselves may or may not be addressed in the document that we have, which is why we need the person who can then try to extrapolate from the comments that maybe the person made in their document and apply that to a different context that maybe the patient hadn't considered in the course of their thinking through this. And so the designation of a healthcare agent is really important for that reason. I'll just also say that we are living at a time, particularly in Vermont, where we have a very a population that's aging, like the rest of the United States. And oftentimes people don't have anybody that they can appoint. They don't have anybody that's close to them. They don't trust anyone to do this. And so I'm not saying it's a requirement to have a healthcare agent, but I do think it's beneficial because sometimes we just need more information and we're not going to be able to get it directly from the patient. If you're in a situation, though, where you don't have someone that you would feel comfortable naming, then by all means, give as much detail as you can, not so much about specific treatment, but about the broader goals. What matters most to you? How can we assure that, you know, the treatment that we're providing or in the care that we're recommending aligns with what values most so that we can do our very best if we don't have another person to sort of help provide more context to the situation?
Let's try to squeeze in one more caller here. Sherry in Brattleboro is on the line. Sherry, what are your comments? And we only have about a minute left here.
Yeah, thank you so much for this wonderful program. I just wanted to let folks know there is an additional free resource for listeners in southeastern Vermont that helps people do free advanced care planning, and that's through Brattleboro Area Hospice. We're a nonprofit, so just wanted to add that, and we are so lucky in this state to have the Vermont Ethics Network as well. And people can find out more information at brattleborohospice.org.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Sherry, for sharing that information with us today. Eva, I'd like to give you the last word here. As somebody who has these conversations day in and day out with people, for someone, I'm specifically thinking here of maybe our younger listeners who might want to start this conversation with an older family member, maybe a parent, and are nervous about doing it. Can you provide me one piece of advice or encouragement for someone in those shoes?
Oh, that's always a difficult thing to contemplate starting this conversation. I think treating it as something that you need for yourself, if you're trying to talk to your parents, as mom, dad, you know, I need some guidance so that I can do what's right. Would you be willing to at least talk to me about some of these things so that the burden of these decisions, if they ever come to me, are lessened? The more I understand about what you want, the less I'm going to feel responsible for those decisions. And if something happens, the less guilt I may have. So I think, you know, kind of not so much making it about death, but about the relationship and how we can each honor each other.
Well, those are wise words to end on. Eva Zivitz, a registered nurse in palliative care at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you.
We are also joined this hour by Cindy Bruzzese, the executive director of the Vermont Ethics Network. On their website, you can find lots of the resources for having these conversations about advanced directives that we discussed today. Cindy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And we had Nina Keck with us as well. She's a Vermont Public senior reporter whose work focuses on aging in Vermont. She is based in Rutland. Nina, thank you so much for giving us the idea for this conversation and for all your wonderful reporting on it.
Always a pleasure, Michaela.
Well, that is all the time that we have for today. If you'd like to look back at our other shows in our In Good Health series, you can find them in the Vermont Edition podcast feed or on vermontpublic.org. We have one more segment coming up next Thursday, so stay tuned for that one. Today's show was directed by Liz Fullerton. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Anna Berg is our intern. Our call screener today was Rick Barrett, and our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.